Will I not in that day, says the oracle of Jehovah, scatter the wise men from out of Edom and his wisdom from Esau's mountain? Esau meaning rough and thus hairy also. Esau was the brother of Jacob, the twin brother of Jacob. And they were born to their father Isaac, and their mother was Rebekah, actually. Because, if I recall, Isaac was sent to get a wife from the land of Syria, or the city Haran, where Abraham had lived previously, and his relatives were still there in Haran. And Isaac was actually, come to think of it, Isaac himself didn't go there, but he sent someone to get a wife, and she came back to Israel to live with and marry Isaac. So, but Esau was the son of Isaac. He was the firstborn son. But as they were being born, Jacob, his brother, came out afterward grabbing the heel of Esau, and that indicated, and also the name Jacob indicated, that he was to be a supplanter, someone who would, you know, cast out Esau from his firstborn position, firstborn right. And that was approved by Jehovah. He approved that. He determined that that would be so, and it wasn't all that different with the later case of how, let me think now, what am I referring to? Well, in the case of Joseph, what was I thinking of? But, I mean, Joseph obviously, well, he wasn't the firstborn son. But I know his sons, that's right, in the case of Joseph's sons. But even Joseph became the firstborn, because the firstborn from Jacob's first wife, Leah, Reuben, was the firstborn. He was unfaithful. He committed a bad sin, lost his right as firstborn, and therefore the right of firstborn went to Joseph, the firstborn of Rachel, the other wife of Jacob. So Joseph wasn't firstborn, and he supplanted Reuben also. This is annoying. There we go. There's an ad that kept changing and flashing. But, okay. So, and also, not only that, Joseph's sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh was firstborn, but Ephraim, the younger one, was declared in prophecy by his grandfather Jacob as being the one to dominate over his older brother. That was, and so Manasseh again was supplanted by his brother Ephraim. So this is a common theme in the Bible, actually. And just like Jesus taught about at the later time of day when there were workers sent out, and the owner of the vineyard wanted to pay the later workers who only worked a very small fraction of the day the same price, the same wage he wanted to pay them. And the other workers thought, well, that doesn't seem fair, right? Because they had worked the whole day and not received any more than this person who worked only a fraction. But that was the illustration that Jesus gave to show that supplanting is actually something that Jehovah permits, and it was perfectly within within the realm of the things that Jehovah does to allow some newcomer to come along and take the place of somebody who's been you know, assuming that they have all the power or all the recognition or whatever it is, all the money, all the firstborn rights or place of first recognition, right? That's a powerful illustration. We should look that up, too. I want to look that up. If we look up the expression heat of the day, I think we'll find it. Because these workers had to bear the heat of the day. And they still didn't get any more. These last put in 1 hour's work, they said. Still, you made them equal to us who bore the burden of the day and the burning heat. But look what Jesus said in reply to these murmuring workers. He said, in the illustration, the man said, well, you agreed that I would pay you that fixed amount that I agreed on. I want to give to the last one here the same as to you. But then he also said, at the end of the illustration, Jesus said, he added the words, in this way the last ones will be first and the first ones last. Showing that you could come very late into Christianity and receive a very large amount of favor. That's a very important principle, and that's something which you see by false teachers, you know, is ignored. Because they don't want to lose their position to some newcomer, so they'll ignore that one, that idea. And now, resuming our study, by the way, that scripture in Obadiah, this whole chapter of Obadiah, if you look at Jeremiah chapter 49, there's a lot of similar ideas. For example, Jeremiah 49 and 16, you see, though thou, in the King James Version, though thou shouldst make thy nest as high as the eagle, I will bring thee down from thence. And Obadiah, though you may soar like an eagle, though you may place your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the oracle of Jehovah. Obadiah 1 and 4. And all the way, there are several, quite a lot of similarities between Obadiah chapter 1, which is the only chapter of Obadiah, and Jeremiah chapter 49. The part of Jeremiah 49 that talks about Edom, which begins in verse 8. Right. A lot of similarities there. Up to at least verse 17. I'm not sure whether Obadiah is going to come up with, let's see, well, it mentions Teman there, verse 9. Anyway, let's not get ahead of ourselves in our study of Obadiah. Continuing our study of the article, the Ark of Urartu now. We have a document called manuscript number 206 from the Shoyan collection, which is an example of square Hebrew. It's called square. We'll look at it here. Where did I write that? Or where did we see that? There it is. It's called, at the bottom of this, maybe it's going to be cut off, though. Let me shrink it so we can make sure we can read it. Yeah, Hebrew Square Book Script, it's called. And you see it's this full page of two columns of this square script. It's very low resolution. The only images I could get were low resolution, as was true also of the Syriac example of that writing. But this Hebrew writing, look at it, it's so ornate in a sense, because the letters Lamed on the first line have extenders that go way, way up, which is the letter L in the English language. They extend way up on the first line there, showing the flair of the scribes, their artistic flair. But the lettering is square-shaped. That's the Hebrew that we see today. This is from the first half of the 11th century. In other words, about 1050 CE, which is, you know, 1,000 years ago. About, which is interesting, we still see the same lettering style today. That's Hebrew, with no, well, the vowels are shown as these points, right? It was not an alphabet, it was an abjad. So where we talk about this sacred Hebrew alphabet, it's really an abjad. Now, reading this paragraph 12 of chapter 10, the last paragraph of this chapter, the writing contained in the Holy Writ is from the highest authority, of whom, capital W, uppercase W, whom, of whom many an imitation and adaptation arise. The Bible is proof that Noah preserved writing on the ark. Isn't that a big statement? The Bible is proof that Noah preserved writing on the ark. Not that he wrote on the ark's surface, but that he wrote or carried with him writings when he was on the ark. And this writing was a sacred Hebrew alphabet created before the deluge, although possibly without any vowels. The eclipse of Nimrod, 2774 BCE, dates the Tower of Babel, Sumerian writing, and most alphabets later, that is later than 2774. Although I'm not sure why there couldn't have been writing prior to 2774. But at the time that I wrote this, I had a certain idea about languages in written form other than Hebrew not having existed prior to 2774. That may be actually true. Very hard to prove. With historic evidence, the Septuagint is most consistent. In other words, of all sources, the Septuagint is the most consistent, probably, of any document, but of the Bible manuscripts. The Chinese evidence may be used to date independently a person named Fo He. Compare with the name Fu Shi, it's the same name, whom we identify with Kainan or Kainam of the Septuagint as 2752 BCE, according to John Brocklesby's book, Elements of Astronomy, page 323, in confirmation of Wikipedia's 2852 to 2727 BCE, as given above. Now, Wikipedia later made it more difficult to find that information, but that was how they dated Fu Shi from the Chinese ancient, were actually not so ancient because the most ancient documents from the Chinese records are not dating that far back. Certainly only a few hundred years. Let's see where it is. John Brocklesby. Let's click on that and see whether we have it. There it is. So let's save this. Let's download the PDF version of it. And then save it, because I don't think I have it. These are old books. Freely, you know, they're in the public domain. They're freely available. So there it is. Export as PDF. Where am I going to add? Let me take it somewhere else. Okay. Yeah, let's take it somewhere else. So I can do it over here. Exports. Let's just put it right there. There we have it. That's good. Okay. Oh, look at this. This is xylitol, right? I want to talk about this actually today. It's a remarkable. That's a remarkable document, a scientific paper. We're going to talk about xylitol, hopefully, if we have time. But in this, from this document, it's a book by John Brocklesby from 1872, Elements of Astronomy, it's called. He says, on page 323, he says, Fohey constructed astronomical tables and instituted sacrifices at the times of the solstices. This year, the winter solstice was December 21st, for example. And that's just the time when the day is longest, it's longest at the summer solstice and shortest at the winter solstice. So ever since December 21st this year, our day is getting longer and summer is approaching. Monsieur Jean-Sylvain Bailey testifies on the astronomy of Fohey. And Monsieur Jean-Sylvain Bailey is another scholar who was somebody whose work was used by John Playfair in his book, and where he gave us some information about the tables of Turbolori. The strong belief of the Chinese, Mr. Bailey said, entertain that the monuments of Fohey contain an ancient astronomy. Fohey, remember, he's the person that we call Kainan, and he lived or had a very significant position as sort of honorary Chinese emperor, at least, at the time of 2852 BCE until 2727 BCE. Or that is that his life? No, that's not his entire life, because he lived longer. The person Kainan lived quite a bit longer than that. Until 2727. I don't know if that. Let's find out. Let's quickly go back and search for Fuxi, see what we find. That was his reign, right? Well, that's right. Shunong began. It should say 37. That's just a typo. Oh, I thought there was something wrong. So that's a typo. So that's 2737 is where his reign ended, right? So that's what that should say. I'll correct that. I'll make a note of it and correct it later. Okay, so the strong belief the Chinese entertain that the monuments of Fohey contain an ancient astronomy established by that emperor is a proof that it was introduced into China by Fohey, whom we call Fuxi. Then, we find, the year consisting of 365 days, 6 hours, with the bisextile, in brackets, leap year, I have good reason to be of opinion that all those branches of science belong to the time of Fohey. Quite a profound statement, isn't it? Quite a significant, strong opinion, strong statement about Fuxi, or as he's also called, Fohey, who lived at such an ancient time that he knew about the length of the year and, you know, this 365 and a quarter days, which was involved in the Julian calendar, but the Egyptian calendar didn't recognize the extra quarter day. But the Julian calendar came more than 2,000 years later, so that's quite advanced for that time period. Now coming down to the bamboo slips are from 400 to 221, or 403 to 221 BCE, to be more precise. There were 2,388 bamboo slips in this group of the Tsinghua bamboo slips, recording parts of the Chinese document called Classic of History or Book of History, Shu Jing in Chinese. And one Tsinghua bamboo slip gave a radiocarbon date of 305 BCE. So they were as old as 305 or 300 years roughly BCE. These ancient documents that aren't as ancient as the time period of Fuxi, of course, so they must have been transmitted for hundreds of years. In the time of Chinese Emperor Yao, which is 2333 to 2234 BCE, time period of 99 years. That's a much later time, 400 years after Fuxi, from the records of the grand historian. We read this confirmation. The Chinese, let me see if I have that. Maybe we could do it. Yeah, let's see what it sounds like in Chinese.
乃命羲和，星若昊天，立向日月星辰，尽寿明时.
And that's translated as, he commanded the she's and he's in reverent accordance with their observation of the wide heavens to calculate and delineate, in brackets, the movements and appearances of, end bracket, the sun, the moon, the stars, and the zodiacal spaces, and so to deliver respectfully the seasons to be observed by the people. Shi, or pronounced Shi, is also Fu Shi. The mathematics of astronomy requires records and writing. India's astronomy is older than their tables of Tervalori. That is the end of our study of that paragraph for today. The end of chapter 10. It's the end of our study of chapter 10. There's even some more. There's some more references to other documents here. Look at them all. Quite a few. Okay. Yeah. And tomorrow, Jehovah willing, we'll be beginning the study of chapter 11 called Kunlun Mountains. Chapter 10 was called Ancient Writing, I believe, wasn't it? I couldn't remember the name the other day of this chapter 10. Let's go back to the beginning of it, see if we can find out what chapter 10 was called. Ancient Writing, right. There we are. Well, the next chapter, 11, is called Kunlun Mountains. And this is one of the perhaps most exciting chapters with regard to the history of China that we have written about in this article, or perhaps any of the articles, because this Kunlun Mountains chapter talks about the Jade Palace. It's such a legendary thing. Like, it's very, very ancient history, but it's so ancient that it's like a legend. And we are getting some insight from our study that we did, or that I did on my own, essentially. I was studying all this during the time that I wrote this, 2010 to 2011 of the Common Era. But, okay, we're going to be looking at that. But now I want to look at some health things, okay? I had strep throat for 3 days, or three times, or so I thought. Anyway, I'm trying to think whether the last time... I guess I can't be sure that the last time was strep throat, but I think it was. I believe it was. But you can really tell when your sore throat is not just a sore throat, because you start to get, you know, anxious because you realize you're getting sicker. It's a different feeling when you have strep throat. So I can say that the cause of it was, it was caused by my, or I believe now, but I guess I can't really be sure, but at least part of it was caused by my humidifier. Because my humidifier was, I could see, contaminated with this purple or pink bacteria at the very bottom of it, where you never look usually. But I was using distilled water, and I didn't think it would get bacteria, because distilled water can't grow anything, right? So I couldn't see how it could get contaminated, but I was wrong. So the other thing is, if I look back, where did I first get this? Let's go back to where I first got the strep throat. Here it is. There's, I took a lot of 1 gram amounts. Where is it? I'm trying to find out. I'm blocking the, let's see. Let me see if I can stay on cam while I do this. I got suspicious that maybe the probiotic I was taking could have been causing it. But I'll talk about something else, too, if I have time. Or we're running out of time. I wanted to say that xylitol, that's the thing I used the last time. Instead of trying vitamin C, I used xylitol, because you can gargle with a 25% solution of xylitol, which is like a tablespoon and a quarter in two tablespoons of water. That's what the 25% solution of xylitol is. You gargle with that, and that stuff, xylitol, kills the strep virus that causes strep throat, or it completely inhibits. That's what I want to say. So this was even December 21st. I was taking a lot of vitamin C, and then on the 23rd, I started taking 4 gram quantities. And so in that time period, in the past 7 days, I've had, or 6 days, because today I don't have it, in the past 7 days inclusive, I've had strep throat 3 times. That's what I believe. And then, this is the research paper where they show that xylitol compared to erythritol, if you take a 10% solution of xylitol, it inhibits more than 95% of the Streptococcus pyogenes, which is the strep virus that causes strep throat. So 10% solution is all you have to have to almost eliminate that virus. You can also eat xylitol. And I've been eating xylitol, and I found out that the overdose of xylitol is less than 1 tablespoon. And it causes massive diarrhea, you know, which is actually not so bad if compared to getting strep throat. What happened is I started putting it in my tea, and I didn't realize that it was what was causing it, because I'd also taken quite a bit of, or, you know, at least several grams of vitamin C prior to that. So I wasn't sure what was causing it, but I later realized that the diarrhea that you get from vitamin C is different, and you can recognize the difference. So, So I was able to clearly differentiate between what was caused by the xylitol and vitamin C. You get used to it, you know. But xylitol has these health benefits. So we see that is a magnificent chart But what is, can we see it there? I'm going to go back over here. The health benefits of, look at the health, let's see if we can find this, what I had here. There it is. That's the article that I was just showing the chart from. It's a scientific paper. Okay, it's, that's the solubility of, you can dissolve an awful lot of xylitol in a very small amount of water, basically, is what that's about. But the density of xylitol is, I had to find that out. It doesn't break down xylitol in boiling water. It's got a boiling point that's much higher than water, much higher than the boiling point of water, 421 Fahrenheit or 216 Celsius compared to 212 and 100, respectively, for water. For dogs, it can cause damage. That's what that's talking about. It's not like that with humans. It's really, really... It's dangerous for dogs. That's worth knowing. The number of health benefits from xylitol, I'm trying to find it. So many. Where was it? I'm going to have to try and find that. Yeah, here it is. Does xylitol cure diabetes and cancer? And that's what I was looking for, and infection. What diseases does xylitol cure? Look at this. This is incredible. It modulates it improves the immune system also. It improves bone mineral density. It relieves constipation. It is antimicrobial. It kills all the bad bacteria. So you put it in your mouth. It lets the good bacteria live, but it kills all the bad bacteria. So it's really good for your teeth. Like it eliminates cavities. It's, phenomenal in that regard, but it'll kill the strep throat. Gargle with it as a solution, 25% of that, which is what I already mentioned. The respiratory tract infection is less likely. Sinusitis is less likely. And otitis. All the risks are reduced with xylitol. And I think it's actually, it's anti-cancer. Like it's... It is. That's another thing about it. So that's it for today's study. It really has a restraining effect on cancer. It inhibits cancer. So this is December 30th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 15:16 hours Canadian Eastern Time, and I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Sissy, and this is Star saying bye for now. We finished Chapter 10 today, Paragraph 12. Thank you so much for listening and watching. Xylitol is indeed a phenomenal thing, and you can take it and build up your ability to take it so you can take more of it as your body gets adapted to it, I believe, too. But it's a natural substance. It's just a sugar alcohol, which has nothing to do with the alcohol that makes people intoxicated, so it's not a risk for anyone who is an alcoholic. And that's it. But we can't cover it all, obviously. It's such a phenomenal thing. But that's it for today. Bye for now.